Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Sequelizing, a movie rewatch podcast where we tackle the triumphs and dissect the disasters of modern movie franchises. Fresh off scavenging the wreckage of Star Destroyers, I'm KC, and joining me today are...
Translation, I am your Fox Pen Backlash.
I'm No Chris Alive, sequelize its Mastodon of the Monotone, and should I talk first? Do you want to talk first?
Oh, that's a reference to the movie. I got really confused for a second.
Yes, it's a very forgettable reference, but...
No, it's a good one.
Yeah.
And today we finally get to talk about Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, how... I've kind of been waiting for this moment. I feel like everything's been building up to this moment where we get to talk at length in about these movies that I feel like we're gonna love to and hate one, or like one and love it. It's the conversation is gonna be very, very interesting. Just before, what were your guys' thoughts before? Like, you turned it on to watch it again.
I feel like everyone's opinions on the previous two trilogies are pretty much always the same. Everyone loves the original trilogy. Everyone hates the prequels, except for prequel apologists. This trilogy, it's all over the place. Like, even from movie to movie. Like, you can find someone who likes the first one, hates the second one, and there's people who even stick for the third one. I don't fully understand that, but I'm not going to get into that. Going back to this, I remember watching this in the theater. And unfortunately, I was one of those guys who walked away from it and was like, wait a minute. That was just A New Hope again. I couldn't not see it when I saw it. I'm like desert planet looking for a droid. Got to blow up a big thing. Yeah, I've been here before.
This would have been the first time since its theatrical release that I had seen The Force Awakens. And I came away from it with similar thoughts of the echoes of previous movies, but I ended up enjoying it. And I never saw it again on video, very likely because the people that I was hanging out with were far too embroiled in the negative discourse in its direction, disliking it for very stupid reasons, not realizing that it's not a big deal. And but nevertheless, I liked it, and so I was pretty excited to see it this time. And to Backlash's point, very controversial. These are not even a decade old yet, and I feel as if people will still be needlessly debating them as time goes on. But I mean, hey, as long as we could get put forth our take on it.
Yeah, I was very... I think I talked about this last episode. Because of just how toxic the discourse was around even this movie, which I don't know if it was just like the people I was following on Twitter, but this was even this movie, which I think most people would say is like the least controversial one, I saw a lot of weird discourse about it. Initially, upon watching it, I didn't get too many in A New Hope vibes the first time I watched it. Having gone back and rewatched it now, I definitely do get why people felt that way.
I think that there are distinct enough differences, and I found it a bit less like it this time around, and I'll see if I can explain why. The really shitty takes, as far as I can tell, also occurred in its pre-release. Like, as soon as people saw John Boyega, they fucking completely went nuts.
Yeah, the unfortunate thing about this particular movie is that it gets into a lot of weird culture of the moment of, I'll just say it, like, angry, like, nerdy white Star Wars fans claiming that like all this diversity was being forced on them, essentially, and it was, you know, Disney was just trying to shill to the masses and a appeal to the broadest possible demographic, and blah, 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 fucking blah.
Well, and to that I say, no shit. Like, why wouldn't you?
One can have two simultaneous thoughts in their head that, yes, there's a cynicism involved in the casting, but also they cast very good actors. So
yeah, they're not just casting Joe Schmo because he's black and casting any old woman in this franchise. The actors that they got for this movie.
Let's just say, because we never touched on this, casting Samuel L. Jackson in a role he's not suited for.
Yeah. Samuel L. Jackson puts... I mean, I like Mace Windu, but I feel like I ironically like him. Like, he's not actually a good character, and he's kind of a dumbass in all the movies, but maybe I just like seeing Samuel L. Jackson and stuff.
Yeah. Who wouldn't?
But yeah, this movie is probably the first example of not understanding what the intent of the author was. I see the same kind of thing happen with Star Trek, where science fiction fans are like, oh, they're just trying to shove this agenda down our throats with this diversity. And I'm like, have you not watched Star Trek at all?
That's definitely like an even far more absurd response.
Yeah. I mean, at least with this, you could say, okay, well, the first movies, they had all white cast, like a predominantly white cast. You know, Billy Dee Williams was a late entry to the canon. But even so, it's like, yeah, it's our three leads are white, but like there's also an alien, and there's these two droids, and there's a devil man, and there's Greedo, and there's this, we have no idea what Darth Vader looks like. And so there's a lot of the diversity I feel in the first movie is a lot more implied because there's aliens and things of that nature. Yeah, just the discourse around this movie and especially around the next movie, which, oh boy, that was a whole, like, if you thought it was bad in this situation, it's a whole different kettle of fish in the next movie.
Yeah, we that's going to be one we need to mentally prepare for a few days.
I think I'm going to really try to boil down my thoughts because I can and I have spent hours talking about The Last Jedi, and I think we could probably do that in podcast form, but I'm trying to like actually focus my thoughts on like what lies at the heart of all this discontent over, you know, to some degree this movie, but definitely with The Last Jedi as well, because these two movies kind of walk hand in hand with how they were received. But with that, all that said, now we get to a little trivia and background on Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Is the first official mainline Star Wars movie that is not directed or does not include any direct involvement from George Lucas. Lucas would essentially hand over the rough ideas he had for the sequel trilogy he was planning to new Lucasfilm president Kathleen Kennedy and Disney CEO Bob Iger, but Lucas's ideas were all but forgotten by the House of Mouse, which apparently frustrated Lucas. As we talked about in our last episode, it was somewhat naive of Lucas to sell the franchise to a mega corporation like Disney and expect that he would be able to craft and take the franchise in a direction he wanted to. But Lucas is infamously resistant to relinquishing control, so perhaps it's not surprising. Naturally, a few big-name directors were rumored to direct this new installment, including Jon Favreau, who kicked off the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Iron Man, and Guillermo del Toro, director of movies such as Pan's Labyrinth and the first Hellboy film, and the second Hellboy film, which was worse. Ultimately, Disney decided on J.J. Abrams, who really received his big break in creating and producing shows for television like Felicity, Lost, Alias, and several other TV shows that are not as good as you remember them being. Abrams made his big screen directorial debut with Mission Impossible 3 and successfully rebooted the Star Trek film franchise before fucking it all up with a Wrath of Khan retread called Star Trek Into Darkness. And yes,
oh boy,
we will get to those movies eventually. The screenplay was originally written by Michael Arndt, who first made waves as the screenwriter of 2006's Little Miss Sunshine, and would go on to write the screenplays for Toy Story 3, the Tom Cruise movie no one remembers called Oblivion, and The Hunger Games Catching Fire, amongst other things. He's been a creative lead as well, and in lots of other successful movies. When Arndt informed Disney that he was going to need an additional 18 months to finish the screenplay for The Force Awakens, Disney naturally balked, and so Arndt left the project, with Abrams bringing back Empire Strikes Back screenwriter Lawrence Kasdan to collaborate on the script, though Kasdan had been involved with the project on some levels since the onset of production. Kathleen Kennedy would remark that they did not have an overarching story for this new trilogy, which, for the warning, will kind of sort of come to back to bite them in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Hamill, Anthony Daniels, Carrie Fisher, and Harrison Ford will all come back to reprise their roles, while Peter Mayhew shared acting duties with Junas Sutamu, a 6'11 basketball player from Europe who was primarily brought in to spell Mayhew, whose health was deteriorating at that point. So Tamu would graduate to being the full-time Chewie by the end of the movie. He is the Chewbacca that we see in the Solo movie. I think he does a fine job.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't have necessarily noticed the difference as far as, like, there's nothing about Chewbacca that was particularly unfun in Solo.
Yeah.
I mean, he's big and hairy and he can go, grrr, I can't do the Chewbacca voice.
Yeah.
At any rate, Luke Skywalker had originally been intended to show up at the halfway point of the movie, but Kasdan and Arndt felt strongly that bringing back Luke in this movie would have stolen the spotlight from the new cast of characters that they were trying to create, and thus Luke himself became one of the MacGuffins that our heroes have to find. The film...
the MacGuffin, more or less.
Basically. The film had a budget of $306 million and went on to rake in an astounding $2.068 billion worldwide. It has a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes and an 86% audience score, which suggests that at least at the time, people were pretty happy with this movie.
I do know a little bit about the production of this movie. Namely, the movie is shot on film, shot with a, I think it's a similar model camera that they shot the original Star Wars with, and even using some of the original lenses from the production.
I thought that because when I was watching the movie, I was like, why is there film grain on the screen? It's so weird. Like, I'm so desensitized to seeing it now that I just assumed that they added it in post, but it's nice to hear that they actually shot it on film.
I mean, it's good that they shot it on film. Using the actual cameras and lenses is a bit fetishistic. Just to be arbitrary about it. They could have done it in digital on location and corrected it a bit, and it still probably would have looked as good. May not have had the same feel, but I mean, they have the means.
Well, there is J.J. Abrams' insistence on using as many practical effects as possible, kind of a rebuttal of the overabundance of CGI in the prequels.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think Kathleen Kennedy actually mentioned that as well, is that she felt as though things had basically come back around to audiences wanting more practical effects as opposed to the CG. And I think they do a really good job in this movie of mixing up the two mediums. So that, you know, there's no CG in this movie that is too egregious, and the practical effects all look really good and don't look like they could have been better accomplished with different film.
Yeah, it's certainly seamless.
And with all that said, we will now get on to Act One, which Chris is going to handle for us.
All right, Act One. As we hear the familiar John Williams theme with seemingly added triangle, The opening crawl notifies us that Luke Skywalker has vanished and tells us of groups such as the Republic, First Order, and Resistance that will only be explained in the broadest terms for three films. After seeing an executor-like Star Destroyer fill the screen, we meet BB-8, a white and orange spherical droid on the desert planet of Jakku. Max von Sydow and Goody pilot Poe Dameron discuss fighting back against the looming threat of the dark side as new model stormtroopers lay waste to the surrounding area. Before Poe and BB-8 can leave with their MacGuffin, the pilot's X-Wing is shot down. Our new berobed and behelmeted villain, Kylo Ren, confronts Max, who recognizes him and tries to bring him back to the light before being cut down. Poe tells BB-8 to lay low while he confronts Ren himself and is soon captured. All the while, a lone stormtrooper is visibly shaken by these events and opts not to participate in the firing squad ordered by his shiny superior. On board the Star Destroyer, said superior browbeats a clearly traumatized FN-2187. Back on Jakku, we see a scavenger rappelling down the husk of a downed Star Destroyer to look for sellable parts. We are introduced to Rey, and the resulting noise is as if millions of misogynistic chuds cry out in terror and are never silenced. The young orphan's Imperial quarry nets her a very small return. After a good look at her solitary yet curious life, she encounters the wayward BB-8 about to be scavenged by Tito. BB won't tell her anything useful, but Rey gives the droid her life story. On Ren's ship, the mysterious invader tries to mind probe Poe to the latter's resistance. Our reluctant stormtrooper, desperate to escape, frees Poe from his shackles, and they hijack a TIE fighter. After some struggle with the docking tether, they are able to begin their escape attempt. Before they can get any significant distance from the Star Destroyer, they are shot down by Imperial forces and crash land on Jakku. Kylo Ren knows that the now rechristened Finn is responsible and orders his forces to pursue the two fugitives. Finn wakes up distraught and without any trace of Poe save for his jacket. Desperate for some nourishment, the former stormtrooper finds the scavenger camp. BB-8 notices Finn, and Rey, having defended herself against a bunch of ruffians, charges at him, the droid having identified him as a thief of his master's jacket. Convincing Rey that he is a member of the Resistance, Finn gets in their good graces. Before long, however, the young heroes find themselves pursued by Imperial forces. Escaping to the nearest plot convenience, known only as the Millennium Falcon, they evade the TIE fighters using their wits, the nearby derelict Star Destroyer, and whatever is left functioning on the old breast bucket. Finally, out of Jakku, Rey and Finn's elation is cut short as they find themselves docked in a strange vessel.
Alrighty. That was a breezy first act.
Yeah.
It felt, I think, lending to the A New Hope feeling of everything. A New Hope kind of just, it goes very quickly. There's not a lot of time to linger. I mean, I think that's not what I want to say, because that makes it sound like they don't take the time to establish character or have quiet moments. But I think this first act of the movie is pretty well paced.
I agree. I mean, again, I try to make my summary as breezy as possible, but as far as establishing each of the characters, you see sort of Poe's confidence and ability. You see his fairly good heart from the beginning. You see Finn. You immediately see the type of person he is from the way he reacts to the destruction of the First Order, or rather the havoc wreaked by the First Order. You see the way Rey lives her life, and though I was kind of disappointed by how she then explains to BB-8 who she is, because she has to talk to herself, and when there's a droid that just beeps around, the way they establish her in the previous scenes is very show don't tell, which I'm not trying to assert any evaluative superiority over this from A New Hope, but Luke's whole thing in A New Hope was spoken. It was forwarded through dialogue exchanges. Here you see what she does. You see her etch the sort of days on her wall. You see her sort of admire the rebel helmet and lay next to an AT-AT fighter. You get to see her interact with her environment in a way that shows you who she is.
Yeah, this movie does a really good job of... It would have been easy to just shove Chewie and Han and everything into our face at the beginning, but the fact that they choose not to do that and establish who all of our new main characters are, not just Poe and Rey and Finn, but also Kylo Ren, who I feel like, immediately establishes himself as a different villain to Darth Vader. Yes, he is another guy with a cloak who wears a helmet, but just his manner of speaking and his physicality is completely different than Darth Vader. And so you kind of get the feel that he is not, that he's not a retread kind of right away.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit of setup and payoff with him. Like, what we see early in the film, like, you get the idea, like, oh, he is big Darth Evil guy. But, you know, as we go along, we find out that things aren't, you know, kind of as clear as that. There's some subtle hinting early on. Like, the only thing he's concerned with is the map. He doesn't really care about his orders. He just wants to find the map. And we're going to be finding out that there's very good reason why.
Yes. And furthermore, with the cloak, with the mask, the modified voice, you later learn how deliberate that is on his part, how much hero worship that is, which we get a scene in a later bit of the movie, and also likely encouraged by Snoke, who would probably advise that he sort of put on appearances. Like, for people in his family that he admires more so than others. But also, like, him throughout the plot is a process of unraveling. Like, he seems very cold-hearted at the beginning, and then you get to see, like, his bits of complexity.
When we look at the original trilogy and the prequels as a whole, I feel as though most of what we can say about Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader is sort of us as fans filling in the blanks. When you really think about it, his goals are somewhat poorly defined. Like, what Vader really wants from everything is not as clear compared to Kylo, who is very clearly, you know, he has a goal, he has a purpose in mind, he has, in his mind, a legacy that he wants to live up to. And in so doing, that automatically makes him, one, fundamentally different from Vader, because Vader is basically three different people in all three original trilogy movies. You know, in A New Hope, he's more like a manager or an administrator. In Empire Strikes Back, he is the bad guy. He is the antagonist of the entire movie. And then in Return, he is suddenly thrust into the role of being much more of a pawn of the Emperor. Right here, right now, we know who Kylo is. Or we come to learn who Kylo is, and that is kept consistent mostly through at least 2.5 of these movies. Mm-hmm. I also, it's weird, right? Because I think I've talked about the fact that I'm a black man before, but like, there's something very striking about seeing Finn as a main character in these movies. I think back in the days when I was on Twitter, Twitter was awful. I think someone tried to make the argument that, like, Finn was an Uncle Tom and that he plays second fiddle to all the other characters. No,
Finn has his own goals that he is working towards. His main goal is to get as far away from the First Order as he can, because he knows the firepower they possess. He knows about Starkiller Base. He knows how terrifying they are, and he is frightened to be a part of that. So he just wants to get gone. Everyone else has different motivations. His motivations are clearly his own.
Yeah, and I feel as if he and Rey kind of have parallel arcs or parallel characterizations in the sense that they both, if you want to refer back to the Joseph Campbell Hero with a Thousand Faces, they both go through their own kind of refusal of the call, where Finn immediately strikes up a friendship in this heroic, dashing and capable resistance fighter. But as soon as he's out of view, like he doesn't necessarily care to kind of contribute to the resistance as much as, again, he just wants to get away from the First Order as much as possible. Rey, similarly, although she's very curious, she wants to stay where she is. You want to talk about flaws, like you look at the character as complacent. Like she has like her own refusal to call, like when she touches Luke's lightsaber. But both of them are very strongly portrayed, and neither of them play second fiddle to each other, which again, over the next couple of films, definitely changes. And like more than one person is to blame for that.
Yeah, I thought that person was out of line. I just wanted to have someone else confirm it for me. But yeah, you can't blame Finn necessarily for not wanting to be a part of the resistance, because again, like you said, he sees the power that the First Order has, but also he never really acts to be like a member of a war. Like we learn in this movie that like the stormtroopers that we see now are essentially brainwashed children. You know, they're not clones. They weren't built for this purpose. They were kidnapped and basically put into a form of slavery where they have to work for the Empire and have to be reconditioned after every mission and things of that nature. It kind of, in a way, adds a sense of complexity to stormtroopers that I don't think we see. We certainly don't see in the original trilogy. In the supplemental material for the prequels, such as the Clone Wars TV show, the upcoming The Bad Batch, you know, those go dig deeper into like what makes the clones tick, but we haven't really seen, you know, I kept saying that I kind of want to see things from the Empire's point of view. Here we're getting at least part of that point of view of what exactly is going on with the First Order, with this big evil regime, what makes the people who exist in it do the things that they do.
Yeah. If you want to talk about like some of the other tertiary characters, General Hux is someone who's portrayed well.
Oh my God.
By Domhnall Gleeson.
But I gotta say, if I have a favorite character from these movies, it's General Hux. And even though his character gets completely fucked over in episode 9,
yes,
he is just so gleefully evil.
Yeah, he's essentially the Peter Cushing, except he replaces the sort of quiet or the understated threat of Moff Tarkin with a very lockstep kind of, I mean, they're doing this for a reason, kind of Hitlerian speech making, like iron grip kind of fascist.
Yeah, he didn't just drink the Kool-Aid. He made the Kool-Aid. He passed it out personally to everybody. He is completely all about the First Order.
Right.
There is no hint of him being, you know, hesitant about anything that the First Order has to do. He is gung-ho 110%. Fuck the rebellion. Fuck the Republic. Let's just kill them all, basically.
Yeah.
He is that level of villain. He is very much, in his own way, the Ian McDiarmid of this movie, where he is just gleefully fucking evil.
Yeah.
And it is basically every time he's on screen, it's a joy to watch, especially his interplay with Kylo, because Hux knows that Kylo isn't completely 100% in the game for the First Order. He knows that Kylo is in this for himself.
Right.
And that actually, you know, we talked about how there wasn't an overarching plan for these movies, but that is a plot thread that gets followed up on in The Last Jedi. The fact that these two people clearly do not like each other, do not trust each other, but are forced to work together, it just makes it adds another layer of complexity onto the First Order that we did not see in the Empire. I guess we saw a couple scenes where people questioned Vader, but Vader just like fucking killed them, so it didn't really matter.
Right. And an interesting wrinkle that I didn't notice the first time I watched this was, I forgot whether he was conferring with Phasma or with Kylo, but someone mentions that the conditioning program is his. Like, either he created it, which actually makes me question his age, or he presides over it. Because, like, they question whether, like, after Finn's escape, whether his whole methodology is sound.
Yeah. And he is pissed off over the idea that they're going to use clones. Kylo says kind of bitterly, you know, maybe I should tell Snoke that we should have a clone army. And Hux just has this look on his face like Kylo just called his mother a dirty whore. Like, how fucking dare you, yeah, sir?
My brainchild. But yeah, Captain Phasma. We could talk about this toy. Sorry, Gwendolyn Christie, but I don't think I was alone in like hoping for big things for this character, just because the look was really cool. I guess it was a Boba Fett kind of thing at the end of the day.
Yeah, she totally got Boba Fetted. Mm. When I was still working at Spencer's when this movie came out, and we got so much Captain Phasma shit, just so much of it, and you're just thinking this character has to be the biggest fucking character in the history, because Phasma was on literally everything. T-shirts, keychains, water bottles. It never ended. And then I watched this movie and I was like, and like, you're working in the store and people, when the movie comes out, they're buying stuff and they're buying new hats and shit like that, but like none of the Phasma merchandise really moved.
Oh boy.
And because I hadn't watched the movie, I was like, what's going on? I thought this character was supposed to be a big deal. And then I watched the movie and I was like, oh, so that's why all this merchandise is on clearance now. she's not really a character in this movie.
Not this movie, but
she is something of a character in the next movie ish, which it might be one of the, when we get to it, that might be one of the things I have an issue with as it pertains to The Last Jedi. But in this movie, she is very much Boba Fett. She's here to stand and look cool. I don't know if they did that intentionally or if there was just a lot of her stuff was left on the cutting room floor and had like no purpose in the movie or what, but she's kind of like a nothing character. How do we feel about the Millennium Falcon just being on Jakku? Because
very convenient.
It's convenient. They give an explanation-ish about it. Mainly that it had been passed around between multiple, like, smugglers or whatever the
word. It got stolen from Han, who then that thief had it stolen from them, and then it was stolen from them, and then it ended up on Jakku.
Like, I don't know whether they were trying to sell it to Simon Pegg or it's there. At the very least, regardless of that, I like how the scene incorporates the Star Destroyer. Like, Almost as if, like, almost as if, like, a Chekhov gun. Like, she knows it so well that she knows, like, the ins and outs, and she could fly through it. Like, what so many people fucking miss about Rey is, like, how much sort of, like, visual prep you're given for her capabilities. She is very capable. She's, but again, it in filmic terms, it's communicated.
Well, yeah, that's spelled out on the screen.
And that is kind of one of the big kind of problems people have with Rey. Is she too capable?
I don't feel like she's too capable. I mean,
clearly
living on Jakku isn't a good life, right? Like, there's a village kind of like on the outer reaches of town on Jakku, but for the most part, it seems very much like a you get by how you can. You have to fight for everything you get. If you don't fight for everything you get, well, then guess what? You fucking die because it's a fucking desert planet.
Yeah.
A desert planet that's not even as nice as Tatooine. Like, Jakku aspires to be Tatooine because, like, at least Tatooine has a spaceport. Jakku don't have shit except, like, downed Star Destroyers. So I don't feel like she is overly capable, and I honestly feel like if Rey was a dude, no one would give a shit. Like,
yeah. Like, you think about it. I can accept she knows how to fight. I can accept she knows how to use a lightsaber later on. She's force sensitive, so she has abilities beyond what you would naturally expect. That's all fine for suspension of disbelief. And she's not perfect at everything.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned, the first time she tries to fire a gun, she completely messes it up.
And she's horrified at the fact that she does it too. Like, she is not happy to be firing a gun. She fires because she knows she wants to get away. And that's more in Act Two, but still, like, I don't get the.
Yeah, she's a loner. She's standoffish. She's complacent. Like, we establish flaws, like, whether or not, like, they sort of change over the movie, and the fact that they change over the movie is the point.
Yeah, I just think when people call Rey a Mary Sue, and I'm like, you clearly haven't read / watched the Twilight movies. If you want, like, or you haven't read / watched the 50 Shades of Grey movies, like, if you want a self-insert perfect human being who does nothing wrong, is essentially a terrible person who good things keep happening to, watch those movies and then come back and tell me how Rey, a flawed human being who is, you know, just trying to make her way in the universe, which, you know, the Republic is in control, but it doesn't seem like that control has reached planets like Jakku yet. Certainly, there's planets like Jakku are still kind of fucked when you really think about it. And so, I just think any consideration that she's a Mary Sue, I mean, the only thing I guess would kind of approach that level ish is the fact that she knows how to fly the Millennium Falcon. But if it's just sitting there and the weird faced guy isn't gonna complain about it, if she just he probably makes her fix it. She's probably set in the cockpit. She scavenges around Star Destroyers and has probably seen more than a few different ships. And it's not like she's great at flying the Millennium Falcon right away. Like, she's clearly struggling in that whole scene with the TIE fighters to pilot this ship by herself, to the point where she can barely get it in the air.
Yeah. That's actually something I didn't even think of. Of course she was fixing up that ship, because later on we see her complaining, like, oh, he put this in, but I didn't think it was a good idea.
Yeah, like, I forget his name, but the guy basically makes her put a bunch of shit.
Simon Pegg.
Yeah, so Simon Pegg basically makes her put a bunch of ship on the Millennium, a bunch of shit on the Millennium Falcon that she knows is gonna like ruin its efficiency. So yeah, like as Chris said, everything that Rey knows is communicated. It may not be communicated in the most efficient way, but like, as an audience, you can kind of like fill in the fucking blanks. And we've seen that people who are force sensitive have abilities that are beyond, you know, beyond even their understanding. You know, why was Luke able to bullseye Womp Rats and his whatever? He was able to do it because he was using the force the whole time and he just didn't know it.
Yeah. Is there anything else about this portion of the movie that y'all want to discuss?
Nothing that pops up out of my head right away. So should we move on to Act 2?
Yeah.
All right. I wrote down a little bit of an overlap from what you explained, so I got to kind of edit this on the fly.
It's fine.
Sorry.
As the Falcon is about to be boarded, Rey and Finn attempt to hide, but are found by an old man and a walking shag carpet. But in a shocking twist, it turns out to be none other than Han Solo and Chewbacca. Rey and Finn couldn't be more excited to meet such a legend, but Harrison Ford is too jaded to really give a shit. Before the true nostalgia can begin, several ships approach, all carrying different gangs looking for Han and Chewie. Things look dicey as they quickly notice BB-8 as the droid the First Order is looking for, but Rey unleashes Tentacle Henai to cover for their escape. Finn is almost caught up in it, but his main character immunity means he only gets dragged a bit, unlike being instantly eaten like everyone else. We are then introduced to both Starkiller Base and Supreme Leader Snoke, who will be very important to this new trilogy, I'm sure. General Hux has assured Snoke that their new weapon will wipe out the Republic once and for all, but Snoke is more concerned about the map to Skywalker, informing Kylo Ren that it is in the hands of his father, Han Solo. Dun, dun, dun! Back aboard the Falcon, we get a look at the map, and it's incomplete. Han recounts stories of Luke and how he was betrayed by one of his students and has been in hiding ever since. He refuses to bring them to the Resistance under the pretense that the Falcon can be tracked, instead turning enigmatic Maz Kanata. But both the First Order and the Resistance have spies on the ground. Back with Kylo Ren, we see him praying to Darth Vader's burnt-up helmet for guidance on his path to the dark side. No word if Anakin's charred head is still inside. We're introduced to Maz, who can see right through all our characters' bullshit. She calls out Han for just wanting to avoid Leia, and Finn for just wanting to run away. Rey begs him to stay and fight, but Finn wants her to come with him. Rey still insists on returning to Jakku, but something is calling out to her. She finds her way down to the basement, finding a lightsaber in a box. She touches it and is suddenly filled with visions of places she's never been before, words from people she's never met, visions of Luke Skywalker, visions of herself as a child, and visions of Kylo Ren. Once the visions fade, Maz explains the lightsaber is the one that Luke lost at Cloud City. I'm sure we'll find out how he got it later. She explains that Rey's parents are never coming back for her, and her destiny lies elsewhere. Rey is only freaked out by all of this and runs off into the woods. Back on Starkiller Base, General Hux has turned the fastest ohmmeter up to 11 as he gives a ranting and shouty speech on how the Republic sucks, and the stormtroopers respond with a Hitler-like salute. Starkiller Base fires their giant fuck-off cannon, completely obliterating every planet in the Hosnian system, including Coruscant, destroying the Republic. To make matters worse, the First Order have tracked our heroes and begun an all-out assault. Rey and BB-8 continue to escape into the woods while everyone else has to fight. Finn forgets about the rifle Han gave him earlier and is left to flail awkwardly with Luke's lightsaber. Things seem grim until the Republic shows up and starts clearing house. Rey is unfortunately captured after Kylo Ren learns she has seen the map. Leia arrives to a very awkward meeting with Han, who admits he has seen their son. C-3PO has a red arm. No one cares.
Yeah, that's all. It's C-3PO's red arm is almost like the story of Luke's lightsaber, where C-3PO like hangs a lampshade on it, but then doesn't explain anything about it, and he's just like, "Oh, I wish I had my old."
This is where we get into what I'm calling problematic J.J. Abrams territory. Because it's no secret, J.J. Abrams loves the idea of the mystery box. And he loves the mystery box. You put the mystery box out there, people are going to wonder what's in there. You know, you're going to wonder. It's like, but you have to know what's in there. You have to know that. And I know. And like so many people rip on him for Lost, but it's come out that there was a plan for Lost from the beginning. They just ran out of time to tell the story in a good way.
But yeah, but they ran out of time because it like meandered and didn't really.
Yeah. Because, you know, mystery, itself. adding more questions. What like, it's like, okay, answers now, please.
Like, I think I fucking love the movie Knives Out, right? And in a bit of irony, I'm going to talk about Knives Out probably a lot in The Last Jedi. The thing that works about Knives Out is that there is a mystery. Yes, we're trying to get to the bottom of the mystery. And at one point, we even think we have the answer to the mystery. But they spoon-feed you just enough clues to keep you going, and questions don't linger so long that you don't want to know the answers to them, and they don't linger long enough for you to develop your own crazy theories about it. I think the other thing I can think of that kind of works on that level is WandaVision, which again, just sort of little by little by little into the end. Yes, it's a mystery kind of what's going on, but they give you just enough information so that you're not sitting there wondering, like, you're not sitting there waiting for the show to give you an answer that never comes. Because J.J. Abrams left these plot threads dangling, I think that created a lot of unnecessary drama because he didn't point to what the answers to all these questions could be. And so fans of the movie just sort of filled in the blanks on their own.
Well,
and
in the case of Luke's lightsaber, he not only didn't answer the question, but he kind of gave the audience the finger with Lupita Nyong'o having to say the line, "That is a good question for another time." And it's never, nope, with likely no intention of answering that.
Yeah. At the time, J.J. Abrams was not going to be involved with any future Star Wars movies. So if he didn't include anyone down the line who was involved in writing staff on that, then it's just nothing. It is story writing 101. When you want to make a good mystery, you start with the solution and write backwards.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams' mystery box is, it just doesn't make any sense, like, at all. Like, I think his theory about what the mystery box is doesn't. I think it's him trying to ascribe some great value to how his writing works. But I don't think in practice, if you look at every other show that he's done, the mystery box isn't really a thing. And if you look at the movies that he's done it in, well, then you get Star Trek Into Darkness. So, yeah.
That is one where the mystery box is opened, but what's inside is really, really stupid.
We didn't talk about BB-8.
No, we didn't.
I loved that little orange droid. I immediately wanted a toy of it. I guess that was the intent.
And to anyone who says, like, oh, they just made him for marketing purposes, fuck you. Of course they did.
I mean, you could
like, of course they did.
Like, don't hold George Lucas in such a high regard comparative to others who create things for marketing purposes.
Yeah. I mean, we spent like 15 minutes complaining about the Ewoks, who were literally seemed to only be created so that George Lucas's kids would have toys to play with.
How much merchandising and marketing was in the prequels?
Oh, man. A lot. Oh, man,
this is nothing.
Those Pepsi cans. You almost expect like them to be drinking Pepsi on Coruscant.
Pretty sure there were McDonald's toys. I had like most of the figures. If I still had them, they would probably be worth. Well, no, because everyone fucking bought them, so they're probably not worth anything.
I think at this
point, at least BB-8 is important to the plot.
Yeah,
he has his own personality.
Right, where he's like, he's a bit more aggressive than R2-D2. Like he's almost like kind of snippy the way he kind of shocks Finn.
Yeah. I remembered that scene and I laughed.
So about Rey and Finn's banter, like their whole like giddiness, their collective giddiness is so much fun. Like after they escape with the Millennium Falcon, like before they get boarded, their excitement at being able to evade is like, I love it. They're I still kind of not sure about Finn's line, "You got a boyfriend, cute boyfriend." It's fitting with his character, but like to bring back the specter of the Spoonie experiment forums, someone kind of said something that I agree with, and it's like, I don't know if I want to hear the word boyfriend said in a Star Wars movie, but it is nitpick.
Yeah,
I get it, but it was clear that they were at least attempting to have Rey be a love interest for Finn. Like I'm not crazy in thinking that, right?
No,
like, you're not crazy at all. And I just like to say, fuck Raylo, fuck the fan that brought that into existence.
No, I've always I'm not going to get into that in this movie, because it's not a thing in this movie. But yeah, you can tell with Finn, like basically the second he sees you, he's like, I want some.
Oh boy, there's a pretty white girl over there.
Like, I'm pretty sure that he's been pretty repressed being a stormtrooper.
Yeah, they gave the Hux's training includes like the Jedi credo on women.
Yeah, you can't love anybody, but it's like they have, not to sell the fact that they have a really sweet friendship and kinship between the two of them, I think would have lended itself nicely to a more natural romance than what ends up happening in the next two movies. Like the fact that they're kindred spirits in a lot of ways. And even though they have nothing in common, they kind of have a lot in common. And it bugs me that this, for reasons that I don't know, which again, it's one of the problems that I have with The Last Jedi, that is that whole thing is kind of dropped and we don't really ever pick it up again.
We'll discuss who's to blame for that, because there is someone to blame, as much as I'd like to defend him from other criticisms.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you've been sitting there wondering, like, oh my god, they're going to defend The Last Jedi, we're not going to defend all of it.
Yeah.
No, the movie has problems.
Yeah. So, Maz Kanata's, like, in addition to her thing about the lightsaber, when she's discussing sort of the fight that they need to be in, she says the only fight against the dark side, the Sith, the Empire, today it is the First Order. It almost kind of makes it seem, it's like that Terminator 3 line, Judgment Day is inevitable. Where it's like, not to say that it sort of negates anything done in the previous movies, but it's almost like too convenient an excuse to have like a representative of the dark side. Because we don't really get too much of an idea of the First Order throughout. As good as Hux, as interesting as Hux is as a character, and as interesting Kylo Ren is.
Yeah, we in the original trilogy, you get a lot more of an idea of what the Empire is, but the Empire is in control at that point, so it is easier to understand kind of how the Empire works. The First Order, for all intents and purposes, it's hard to understand, given what happens at the end of Return of the Jedi, how the First Order comes to be.
Right.
And they don't really explain it, because why? I mean, and it,
the thing there is a canon. There is an established canon. I'm going to recommend a YouTube channel to everyone. It's called the Templin Institute, which they examine fictional realities, and it's presented as we're peering into alternate realities. It's really cool. And I remember that there is a canon. I'm not sure where they got it from. It's probably fleshed out in the comics, but like after the Empire, like after the Emperor died, after the Emperor died,
so much for that canon.
There was an attempt to rally the Empire together by one high-ranking officer, and it failed. They were basically just shot down by the rebellion, and it all just scattered to the wind, and the First Order kind of rose from that.
Okay.
And the thing is, I don't think the First Order is supposed to be all that big. Like, they have Starkiller Base, but I can't imagine they're like the de facto government. Like, they oppose the Republic, of course, but it always struck me as, like, this is, like, a fledgling splinter group of the Empire, and like they're using salvage technology. There's lines in the movie that say that they're basically using recovered data from the Empire, and they've just now managed to get to like start building with Snoke as
right.
Like,
okay,
like this is kind of like the beginning. And it's the Starkiller Base is their big trump card, and they use that to destroy the Republic. And it's what it's going to play into one of the themes I think they were going for in Last Jedi that they completely ignore in Episode 9.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. I mean, I just from the standpoint of the films, like if I could, if forgive me for saying that I'm about to like deliver a hot take. I think in the sequel trilogy, the ideas of the First Order on paper are not very well defined, but in execution are pretty cool. In prequels, mm-hmm. on paper, I'd say it's much better defined. In execution, it really sucks.
Yeah.
Because there's at least...
I would agree.
You have, like, the Republic, you have the Senate, you at least have some kind of a structure, fucking elected monarch aside. but at the very... Yeah, but it just doesn't come off. Whereas... supplemental material is cool. I have a feeling that they're probably going to explain things like this in some of the Disney Plus series. I would not be surprised.
Yeah, and there are canon novels that cover kind of, you know, there's a canon novel about Padme that I actually want to read because people say it's really good. And I'm sure there will be more sort of canon material that fills into blanks as to like how the First Order came to be. But I never got the impression that like the First Order is like, you know, I definitely don't think that the First Order just has like a bunch of Star Destroyers just chilling out on a planet or something, just waiting for people to use them. Yeah. If you know what I mean. Yeah.
So does anyone have any recollection of this meme from when The Force Awakens came out of the dude who yells traitor at Finn and takes out his shock stick, and everyone was like, oh, they should call that character TR-8R. Like, everyone, like, the people that were, like, singing praises about that seemed to be one of the things that they attached to. And for the scene where you get to see Finn use the lightsaber for the first time, it's a nice thing to hinge on.
Yeah, I think I like that scene. It was kind of cool, because one thing I did think was weird was that, you know, Finn is trying to escape, but he does kind of like blow up people that I'm pretty sure he knows, and maybe the reconditioning kind of like, I imagine there's not a lot of familial relations or friendships and stuff like that. But the fact that he just kind of is like starts murking stormtroopers without a second thought is a little bit weird.
I think it's just, I know he stabs one like through, like directly through his gut, and I think then he's confronted. But I'm not sure. Like, does it show him kill, like, a lot of people?
When him and Poe are escaping from the Star Destroyer and he's on the guns, he blows up
a lot.
So, yeah. It's understandable that he just wants to escape. I just thought that was, like, a weird quirk of the writing of the movie. Seeing Han and Chewie, it just, every time that every time I see this movie and Han says, "Chewie, we're home," it doesn't matter how fucking cheesy it is. I'm just like, damn right you're home, Harrison Ford. Damn right you're home.
Yeah, I think Harrison Ford is, there's only one scene that'll point out later that I don't think he's game for, but like, I think for most of it he is. I like how, the exchange between him and Chewie, like, I'm gonna do what I always do, talk my way out of it, and then Chewie complains and he's like, yes I do every time, like it smacks that old sort of Han Solo.
Yeah, I made that joke about Harrison Ford being too jaded to give a shit, but that's kind of just on him in general. Like, the last few years he's been in movies, you can tell he's just sleepwalking through most of it. Not so much in this movie.
Yeah, I think he kind of falls right back into that Han role. But if he is jaded, it comes across in the character, because Han should be somewhat jaded. I mean, if we're gonna have Han go back to being, you know, a scavenger, a smuggler, you know, a thief, you know, a scoundrel, a scruffy looking nerf herder, it makes sense that he is a bit tired and weary and almost over it. I think the interesting thing is that meeting Rey and meeting Finn kind of gives Han a purpose again.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you can go.
Well, there's a line when he confronts Leia and they're kind of talking about And it's like, well, after they lost their son, he says, I fell back into the only thing I was good at.
Yeah. So he in his depression, because of course, I think it would be fair to say that Han and Leia both fell into a depression after losing their son and losing, you know, their brother. For all intents and purposes, Luke is Han's brother, and he is definitely Leia's brother, that they kind of just almost wanted to like decompress and not think about it anymore. Yeah. So they just went right back to doing what they were doing, whatever it was they were doing before.
Yeah. And people get mad about that. This is like, oh, he's doing the same thing he's been doing this whole time. Wow. Talk about not having character development.
That is a scarily good Plinkett impression.
Yeah. I mean, hey. Number one it is. Number two, I was kind of amused by the fact that, like, Han and Leia didn't work out. Because, like, she's completely responsible and he's consistently irresponsible. Like, you can get sort of growth over movies, and obviously fiction allows these things to stick, but I mean, sometimes you just gotta put a little reason into it.
Yeah. They, as much as they love each other, and I'm going to talk about that in Act 3 a little bit, as much as it's clear that they love each other, it's like Diamond Dallas Page and Kimberly Page. It's like, I love you so much that I can't be with you because you annoy the shit out of me when we're together, but we can be awesome friends. You go off and do your yoga. I'll go be a 40-year-old virgin. It'll be a grand old time.
You're keeping my Leia away from me. I want
Leia. God damn it. I'm getting very tired of your gamesmanship. Very tired.
Quite frankly. But yeah, I like, where were we? Sorry.
talking about how much Luke and Leia clearly love each other.
You mean Han and Leia?
Yeah.
Well, both,
yeah,
both are true.
Sorry. I mean, yeah, but yeah, I was talking specifically about how Han and Leia, they clearly love each other. They just can't be romantically involved, you know? And I kind of like that it makes sense for the characters to not work out. I don't know if that pissed off fans or what, but to me, it makes sense that Han's more... his irresponsibility, as Chris said, would eventually just bother the hell out of Leia, combined with the fact that they lose Kylo to the dark side and lose Luke, who is devastated after losing, you know, after losing Han and Leia's kid. Because of course Luke would feel devastated after that.
I could also say overall that, like, if there's a plot beat, if there's anything in the script of this movie, chances are that someone has a problem with it. So yeah, I know that's a very nihilistic viewpoint, but I mean, yeah, you could point to so many different plot beats and someone will have some kind of issue with it. Some self-professed fans, whatever.
Yeah. And then this is ultimately the point where we do see that Kylo has a much more complex reason for doing the things he does. He doesn't give a I won't say that he doesn't really care about the First Order, but I think he only cares about the First Order in as much as he cares about the image of Darth Vader as the leader of the Empire. I think it's funny that when you really think about it, no one is left alive to tell Ben that Anakin Skywalker was a good person, right?
What's very strange is, well, that kind of makes you wonder about, like, the way Luke handled it, but it seemed like, from the events of Return of the Jedi, the only people who would have known about the truth of Darth Vader were Luke and Leia, maybe Han, and whatever in their circle. Like, it's so his you can understand that his reputation as this big badass, like, dark side general would probably precede that of Anakin Skywalker, since most of the people with firsthand experience of that are dust by now.
Yeah. It's just an interesting, again, Kylo was a really interesting character. Shout out to Adam Driver, who I think makes Kylo on some levels not necessarily in this movie or The Last Jedi, but certainly in Rise of Skywalker, he makes Kylo seem so much more complex and conflicted than you would even hope to imagine. I mean, if you want to talk about someone who was casted perfectly for the role, like, he gets Kylo Ren, and that means the character kind of jumps off the screen.
Right.
I think there's a reason why Kylo Ren kind of became his own kind of icon, and it's not because he's just Darth Vader 2.0. He is very much his own thing.
Right. And furthermore, I from a writing standpoint, I appreciate the irony of always when, like, Kylo Ren is either talking to the helmet or talking to Snoke, it's always about being seduced by the light side, which is never which you never sort of get the perspective of. It's always the dark side is all powerful. The dark side will win. It's never like you must resist the temptation of being good.
Yeah. Anyone else have anything else on Act 2? We all good?
We're good.
I think so.
Alrighty. Then on to Act 3. Our crew is reunited at the home of the Resistance on Dakar. Finn is excited to see that Poe Dameron has escaped Jakku relatively unharmed during a sequence of events that I'm sure was covered in a comic book or whatever. The important thing is that Poe is back, Finn is thrilled, and a million slash fics were written about their implied romance. Poe introduces Finn to Leia, who presses upon him the importance of knowing as much information about the First Order's weapon of mass planetary destruction as possible. BB-8 does indeed have a map of Luke's location, but since it's incomplete, they're basically back to square one. In the meantime, Han and Leia have the kind of touching back and forth that only two people who love each other so much that it can only be expressed in saucy flirtation disguised as sarcastic remarks and irritation can. Because Han and Leia are the original ship that launched a million intergalactic star-crossed romances. On the note of ships, Rule 34 is invoked as BB-8 undresses, BB-8 removes R2-D2's... BB-8 takes the covers off R2. BB-8 runs into R2-D2. C-3PO helpfully tells BB-8 and the rest of the audience that ever since Luke went into hiding, R2-D2 has been operating in low power mode and may never be the same again. Spoiler warning, he winds up being fine. Han and Leia lament the fact that they're awful parents to Kylo Ren. But considering that Han's real dad just up and disappeared while building ships on Corellia, and his fake dad betrayed him to Daenerys Targaryen, and Leia's dad was the actual literal personification of evil incarnate, I think they're being too hard on themselves. Leia swears that there is still good in Kylo because she hasn't watched the rest of the movies and realizes that evil despots can never truly be redeemed. Meanwhile, on a different section of fanfiction.net, Rey is strapped to a metal table and bound by the hands and legs while Kylo Ren watches her sleep. Before this turns into 50 Shades of Lightsabers, Ren attempts to forcibly remove the map Rey saw from her mind. Rey resists and manages to actually turn his back on Kylo Ren, revealing that Kylo Ren's greatest fear is that he will never be as strong as Darth Vader. Ren immediately tattles to Principal Snoke that Rey is Force-sensitive, and while Hux prepares to obliterate Dakar with the Death Star Killer, Snoke informs Ren he needs to bring Rey to him. In the meanwhile, after having her Force powers awakened, hey, it's the title of the movie, by Ren, Rey is able to calmly and smoothly use a Jedi mind trick on a stormtrooper. On a side note, Qui-Gon Jinn is still the only person we've seen use the mind trick for inherently selfish reasons. No particular reason why that's important, just wanted to remind everyone that Qui-Gon was a dick. At any rate, Rey manages to escape, and Ren destroys a perfectly good prison cell about it. Back on Dakar, the Resistance learns about Starkiller Base, and Major Aemon is like, Palpatine did it, and Poe was like, excuse me? And Ackbar is like, Palpatine did it, back when the Empire was still a thing. Before Poe can say, but it's not the same, Imad is like, after he took over the Galactic Senate, just like the First Order just did. And Poe is like, wait, the First Order actually destroyed the Senate, and the Death Star Killer is way bigger, so it's not the same. Han has helped in blowing up at least two Death Stars at this point, and says that every bad guy's base has a weakness. Turns out the not the Death Star, no seriously, is different, can be taken down thanks to, say it with me folks, a small flaw that a targeted strike can destroy and make the whole damn thing blow up. Seriously, like, did no one who built this damn thing even try to read up on how the first two Death Stars were destroyed thanks to flaws exactly like this? Whatever. Han, Finn, and Chewie will head to the, no, you don't get it, it's not the Death Star, really, this one is bigger, to drop the shield surrounding the oscillator they need to take out Han and Leia share one last goodbye, and damn it, why can't these two people just tell each other that they love each other at the same time? Sorry, I think I have some dust in my eyes. Leia also begs Han to bring Ben home, which probably is not going to turn out the way she thinks it is. Han, Finn, and Chewie are able to get past the shields surrounding Starkiller Base due to something-something fractional space magic and crash on the planet. After Han informs Finn on how the Force does and does not work, our intrepid crew makes its way inside the base, and Rey uses some of her newly discovered Force abilities to evade detection. Han and Finn and Chewie are able to capture Lady not appearing in this film despite being on all the marketing, or Phasma for short, and force her to drop the shields, disposing of her in a garbage chute, but not before Phasma alerts the rest of the base. Up in the skies, they fight and 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 they fight, and Han, Finn, and Chewie are finally reunited with Rey. Han realizes they can't escape with the Resistance taking heavy casualties due to be outgunned on the ground, and so Han institutes the only plan he really knows how to implement with any regularity. Blow shit up. Unfortunately, Kylo Ren's Han Solo detector has gone off, and he's off to search for his father. Han and Kylo come face to face, and we learn that Kylo's real name is Ben. Han tries desperately to bring his son back to the light side of the Force, but because this movie actually has balls, Kylo realizes the one thing that can get him the power he desperately craves is by murdering those closest to him. And but so, after asking to die in these movies for the better part of 2 decades, Han Solo passes away. Chewie sees this and basically starts one-shotting motherfuckers in rage, while a devastated Rey and Finn try to make it back to the Falcon. Unfortunately, Ren is standing in their way. While the bombs go off to take down the guns and the X-Wings, run the trench to shoot at the exhaust port / oscillator, Ren force pushes Rey into a tree and faces off with Finn. Finn gives his best effort to try and beat Ren in a lightsaber duel, but can't manage it and winds up severely injured. Ren tries to call for his uncle and grandfather's lightsaber, but instead flies into the outstretched hand of Rey, who seems to be coming into her own with her Force abilities. She is raw, though, and despite being able to somewhat keep Ren at bay, she is outclassed right up until he has her on Eclipse Edge, offering to train her in the ways of the dark side of the Force. Fully coming into her own, Rey is able to calm her mind in the light side of the Force, and then proceeds to whip Ren like a government mule, scarring his face in the process. Rey doesn't get the chance to deliver a killing blow, however, as Space Mountain has decided to come apart at the seams. Rey goes back for Finn and Chewie, and the gang narrowly escapes the planet imploding and make their way back to the base on Dakar. Upon their return, the celebratory mood is deliberately muted between Leia and Rey, who hug each other over what they've lost. Oh well, someone must have recharged R2-D2's plot batteries, as he had chosen the end of the movie at the time to come online and reveal that he has the other part of the map to find Luke. Rey visits an unconscious Finn and promises that they will meet again, tenderly kissing him on the forehead, and a bit of plotting that will go nowhere because Finn has another love interest in the next movie and Rey decides that she's really into bad boys all of a sudden. Typical. With that, and a blessing from Leia, Rey and Chewie head off to Luke's secret location. Rey climbs the rocky shores of what I have decided to call the Scotland planet, what with all the rain and the rocks, and she finally happens upon the mythical Luke Skywalker, who looks bemused to see someone has found him. Our movie ends with Rey removing Anakin Skywalker's lightsaber from her bag and presenting it to Luke. The music swelling as Luke ponders this new girl on his planet, and Rian Johnson ponders what would be the best way to piss off Star Wars fans in literally the first 30 seconds of his movie. Cue Star Wars theme and we are out.
Oh, one correction. It's actually Planet Ireland.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. They did actually shoot that in Ireland.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's Planet Ireland. My fault. But yeah. So Planet the Starkiller Base, like
that to me is the foremost example of this movie being a New Hope retread. I think that I said in the beginning of this that I saw less similarities as it went on, and that's mainly because of the new main characters. I think that they have elements of the old ones, but they're in very interesting pastiche sort of ways. Like, Poe is almost is heroic like Luke and a great pilot, and you want to think of him as Han Solo, but he's not quite a rogue, he's heroic. Finn wants to avoid the action. He's kind of like Han Solo, but he's also someone who needs to realize his destiny in a way like Luke. Whereas Rey herself is Oh, sorry, I've lost this. I wish I'd written this down because I had a better idea of it. But
it's all good.
New Hope, new characters, some similarities. The worst among them being Starkiller Base.
I mean, it really is just the Death Star, only bigger. Like they do have a throwaway line where someone's like, "It's a laser cannon," and Poe was like, "No, actually, this was the Death Star, which had a laser cannon, and this is Starkiller Base." And literally, the only difference is that Starkiller Base is bigger and drains the power out of suns. Which, how do they manage to fire it more than once? Like, this is the part where I can get really pedantic.
They say it has to recharge, but can we just say the Doomsday weapon is powered by green energy?
Oh no! What did you do, Kathleen Kennedy and J.J. Abrams? you had a subtle screed against climate improving the situation with climate change.
Is that another thing they're complaining about?
No, but people should have been complaining about that. but yeah, the one thing I'll say is that like Harrison Ford took Starkiller Base about as seriously as he took the Ewoks in Return of the Jedi. If you look at his reactions during that meeting,
yeah, he's like, that it's flimsy. He's like, man, this script is actually pretty good right up to this fucking part.
Yeah,
but yeah, I don't know. It's not like I have an idea of what else could have ended the movie, but I don't know. I almost would have preferred for them to just make another Death Star, because at least, let's say they make another Death Star, and then, the flaws that killed the first two are covered up, and now our heroes have to figure out, a different way to blow up the Death Star. Like, yeah, it's pat and hacky, but, it's better than claiming that Starkiller Base isn't the Death Star when it clearly is.
They have to blow up more things in order to blow it up. It's not just one thing. It's a general flaw, but the process is like blowing up multiple things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they said, I think the thinking of this movie is we kind of want to ease people back into the series.
Certainly.
Like show them familiar things. Like, yeah, it's still Star Wars. I'm like, I think you went a little too far.
Yeah. It's just it's a little bit.
Get a bit more ambitious.
I don't know. It's one thing in this movie that actually bothers me as a Star Wars fan. Not enough that I would make 18 videos that are 3 hours long about how stupid it is and how Disney is the worst thing to happen to Star Wars since, I don't know, Jar Jar Binks or whatever. Compared to A New Hope, I think this climax, well, compared to really most of the trilogy, the climax to this movie has a story purpose. Like, the climax to A New Hope, because they weren't really planning on doing a sequel, it kind of just is what it is. And, you know, I love the trench run in that movie, but there's not, a whole lot of story or extra character development in that. There is in the climax to Empire, but there definitely isn't in Return of the Jedi.
Right. Well, I mean,
and I,
the Starkiller Base, it's another MacGuffin. What works about these last moments are sort of glimpses into Kylo Ren as a character. The fucking lightsaber battle between Rey and Kylo, who again,
God, it's so good.
Another bane of contention, but as a sort of expansion or as a display of character, she spends the first half of it running away from him, slashing at him, running away. It's only also, when
I want to point this out. What happened to Kylo Ren right before this?
He got right shot.
He got shot, and they cut to that multiple times. Like he's pounding on his side, and you see blood dripping on the ground. The man is injured.
Nah, mate. Raise a Mary Sue.
And he doesn't even seem like he's taking it all that seriously. He's holding the lightsaber with one arm. for most of it. That says to me, like, I got this. I don't need to try as hard.
And it's also like another display. One thing I didn't remember from the first time I watched that I really loved was the scene where he tried to probe Rey. Like, and he not only just tries to use the Force to like dig into her mind, but he tries to be as haughty as possible in belittling her and propping himself up where he says, like, you, a scavenger. I forgot exactly what the context, but like diminishes her. And then he says, you know, I could take whatever I want.
Which is so rapey and creepy. Yeah, he's a fuck and boy. Is awesome.
He's almost like a PUA. Like he fucking, it's just such a good representative performance of just like machismo and like and projected superiority.
Adam Driver's so fucking
and his frustration as the scene goes on, and he notices that she resists him and also sort of like turns it back at him, almost like a kind of like, like in a sense, like a kind of duel between, but whatever. It's a very well acted scene, but in terms of both of them,
yeah. I mean, it's just,
and it plays out again in the duel that they have. It's well directed, well rendered.
I think back to, you know, we talked about how in Empire, Darth Vader for most of their lightsaber duel is just fucking with Luke. Like, he's gonna pin him on the mat, and it's 1-2, oh, no, we going to school. Like, that's what Darth Vader is doing. He's pulling an Undertaker. He's clearly outclassed his opponent, but he's just gonna fuck with him until he's ready to tombstone pile drive him. In this movie, it's very clear that, like, Kylo is kind of doing the same thing, where he's bleeding out, but he's still like, these motherfuckers ain't as good as me. And like, Finn gives it his all and can't really touch Kylo. I think he might land a shot on Kylo, and that's when Kylo just is like, fuck your back, and like lands which like could have been a killing blow. And the same thing happens with Rey, where Rey is just like, she's not really trying to fight. She's like taking her time and taking, you know, trying to almost stick and move. And Kylo is just outclassing her right up into the moment where he offers to teach her, you know, the ways of the dark side of the Force. And she is able to calm her mind and tap into something greater. And like I said in my recap, just like completely fucking kicks his ass. Because he's, up until that point, he's not taking the fight or her seriously. And then as soon as she has some confidence, he gets completely outclassed.
Yeah.
In what I think is supposed to be a showcase of just how Kylo Ren is not as powerful as he thinks he is. And he also doesn't think he's powerful enough anyways.
Yeah, and also just a display, not of Rey being this sort of godlike, having this godlike ability, but just having potential. And once she sees just like a bit of potential, similar in a sense to Luke with the fucking Death Star, with that one shot, once she lets go, she can achieve something.
I mean, I think people are like, well, how'd she get so good at lightsaber fighting? And I'm like, she's fucking not. She's not good. Did you watch the fucking movie? She's running away the entire time. She's on the back foot until literally the last 30 seconds of the fight. Like, and it is only because Kylo Ren is injured and because he's like, he views her as a scavenger that is like not worthy, that it winds up being his downfall. Like, I feel like all this stuff we're talking about is super obvious in the text of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people just sort of saw what they wanted to see, which was that something forced the diversity, something, women, something, blah. I don't know how else to say it except that it's really It's really solid. I think the most hacky bits of it are R2-D2 doesn't work until the plot says he can work, and the Starkiller base are the two bits that I have the most problem with.
That was another response to The Force Awakening, R2-D2.
Yeah.
We'll go with that.
Yeah, because R2-D2 has been force sensitive this whole time.
Droids can do it.
I mean, they can feel pain. Why can't they feel the force?
So
certainly they, I mean, Grievous was like mostly cyborg. He had some sort of force abilities.
Yeah. Sort of as an aside, I was really looking out this time for John Williams' score, because coming away from the sequel trilogy, I didn't really think that there was much that he introduced, but at the very least, I found three distinct leitmotifs. One was Rey's theme when we're first introduced to her, and I think plays a couple of other times. Another one, mm-hmm. one was the First Order or Kylo Ren theme. And another was, mm-hmm. was the Resistance. Like, they had like a nice, like very bombastic kind of triumphant brassy theme. And I thought that he did
good entrance music.
Yeah,
you hit that at a show and the crowd's gonna pop.
Yeah, he did well for himself, more so than I recall.
Yeah, I usually play, you know, part of the score at the end of the episodes, and I actually struggled a little bit to find like a piece of music that I thought would work. I don't think it's because John Williams is a bad composer. Certainly he is not, but I do think his arrangements in this movie probably aren't as notable. I think maybe as we go through the rest of the movies, or fuck Rise of Skywalker. I mean, as we go through The Last Jedi, I think it gets the music gets a little bit stronger, because there's some more, you know, there's some more meat on the character's bones, so to speak, for John Williams to kind of play with. This is a dumb question, but like, what do we make out of, you know, people kind of shipping Poe and Finn? Is that like, is there kind of a romantic subtext to their relationship? Because I kind of feel like it's, in a weird way, it's been placed upon them, even though the only thing that's really there is just that they're really good friends. And
I think that,
yeah,
I think that they're really good friends, and they saved each other's life. And I think that it's completely valid to read it that way. I would not have been disappointed if they brought it to screen. Disney was not about to do that.
No, yeah, which, God, I don't want to talk about Rise of Skywalker. I'll start by saying it now. One thing when you're making a film and you're writing a film, one thing you have to do is make sure that it's like in pro wrestling, there's an idea that when a babyface makes a promise, he has to keep the promise, because if he doesn't keep the promise, then like, what's to keep you coming back the next time the babyface makes a promise? I think the end of The Force Awakens promises something will happen with Luke and Rey that the beginning of The Last Jedi undoes. And I think, because through no real fault of his own, because again, there's no overarching story, J.J. Abrams made a promise in this movie that Luke motherfucking Skywalker, the guy who you remember from Return of the Jedi, is coming back in the next movie. He's going to be the Luke Skywalker that you know and the Luke Skywalker that you love. And as I said, in the first 30 seconds of the movie, you learn that this is the Luke that we know and love, but it's also not the Luke that we thought we were going to get. And because Rian Johnson broke a promise that J.J. Abrams made, like, basically right at the beginning of the movie, I feel like that set a sour tone for that movie that played out throughout the entire rest of it, and people were already pissed and not willing to give it a chance at that point. And I'll leave it at that. What are your guys' final thoughts on The Force Awakens? Backlash, you can start.
It is a good reintroduction to Star Wars, and I think it is a good place to start if you're new to Star Wars.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, for me, I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's all about the characters. I was charmed by three new characters that they introduced and a droid. I thought that the actors were chosen well. I thought that they were written in a way that you could get their characterizations down pretty succinctly. And in general, I was ready for the next movie after I first watched this, and I was impressed on a different level in the second time that I did. Despite some misgivings, like, I still agree with the Starkiller base. I still have issues with lore that's not, like, smoothly explained, but hey, movie for babies.
Yeah, just keep reminding yourself that this is a movie about space wizards fighting with laser swords. Like, keep that thought in your mind as you go through Star Wars, and you'll realize it's probably not as big a deal as you think it is. But yeah, going back and watching this movie, it's just a good movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's just straight up a good movie. It introduces new engaging characters that you want to see what happens with them next. It introduces some nice mysteries that you want to learn about in the next movie. It's just a really, it's, in baseball, it'd be like a really good single at a crucial moment. Like, it's not a home run. It's not even a double, but it's a solid single that gets, you know, a runner on base to score.
I would go so far as to say it's one run batted in, maybe even two.
Yeah, it's just a good movie, mm-hmm. and I think as we get into The Last Jedi, it will, I don't know, man. It's just interesting to see, because yeah, The Force Awakens did get like its fair share of crap, but for the most part, it was universally loved by critics. It was practically universally loved by a majority of the audience, and it's kind of amazing how incredibly divisive The Last Jedi became. You know, we live in the era of the think piece, and seeing how many think pieces were written about The Last Jedi and what it was and what it wasn't and how it made them feel, and you know, this person's an asshole because they like it, and this person's a dick because they don't like it. And again, these movies are about space wizards fighting with laser swords. It's not that serious.
Yeah.
As we go into The Last Jedi, Chris, what are your kind of initial thoughts as we wrap up?
Oh, my initial thoughts. I'm excited to see it. Like, I'm wondering if I'm not going to like it, because when I saw it the first time, I was like, there are a lot of really cool things in that movie, but man, the structure drags. So, like, I'm keeping that prepared. I remember looking at Force Awakens on Disney Plus and being like, oh my god, 2 hours and 18 minutes? This is like the longest fucking movie in the series. Luckily, it was breezy.
Yeah.
But yeah. So excited, but somewhat trepidatious that it'll take too much of my day.
And what about you, Backlash?
I don't know what to feel, because I have seen so many differing opinions over this. And I feel like there's a lot of opinions I don't agree with, but I can't tell how many of them are just coming from like a genuine place or from pissy fan place.
You know what I will say about that? The unfortunate thing is that genuine criticisms of that movie are fucking poisoned by the toxic ones. And it's fucking difficult for, like, you could say that it's easy to sort of pick out, like, all the misogyny, all the racism, all of the general sort of, like, harassment that certain actors and actresses faced. But at the same time, like, it's difficult to even fathom, like, try to make genuine criticisms in the midst of this fucking morass of toxicity.
Yeah,
yeah. Go ahead.
Well, I live by the code: let people like things and let people not like things.
I am like you, Chris. I am both excited and approaching this movie with trepidation. I know that upon my first. I mean, the first time I watched it, I was like, what is the big deal? Like, why is this particular movie so rending the fan base and, like, the country and the planet apart?
I do think that we're prepping a bit much, and we could perhaps... Yeah.
This should be saved for next week's show.
We'll get to it when we get to it.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. All right. So, on that bombshell of us just being like, we're going to have so many thoughts and opinions that we should probably just shut up before this podcast runs another 2 hours. You can find us on Twitter at SequelizeIt. You can drop us an email, SequelizeIt@gmail.com is the email address. You can leave us a voice message on Anchor. And if you want to help the podcast grow, do us a favor. Go to Apple Podcasts or your podcasting app of choice. Leave us a 5-star review. It helps us immensely in ways that no one understands, because no one really understands how the algorithm that runs the internet works. But at any rate, we would greatly appreciate it. And, yep. On to just as a last aside before we get out of here, what episode is going to be longer, Last Jedi or Rise of Skywalker? I asked this at the beginning. I think I asked this in episode 2, but I'm asking it again because now we're at the precipice of doing it.
Back then I said Last Jedi was going to be longer. Now I'm not so sure, because I feel like Rise of Skywalker is just going to be depressing and we're going to be low energy.
I kind of agree with that, but like, what I want to say is I want to preempt this and say that we don't have to fucking spend time focusing on goddamn everything in the Rise of Skywalker, so let's resolve to not. And you could play this clip at the beginning of the 3-hour Rise of Skywalker episode. Just to make me look like a hypocrite when I join in on this.
All right, so it's going to be a goodbye from me, Casey.
I am your foxy friend, Backlash.
And I am No Chris Alive.
And we will see you next time on Sequelize It.